At its peak of power, circa 1990, America controlled the global economy, exercised unchallenged military power, and set the political agenda for much of the world. But by 2010, after a decade of war and economic crisis, the U.S. dominion seemed at the brink of decline, prompting President Barack Obama to warn Congress of serious challenges to America's global power. Quote, China is not waiting to revamp its economy. Germany is not waiting. India is not waiting, he said. These nations aren't playing for second place. And then, in a rhetorical flourish that brought thunderous bipartisan applause from the U.S. Congress, he announced, well, I do not accept second place for the United States of America.
Has American global domination passed its peak, just as the British, French, and Spanish empires did? And if it has, what might the future hold? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
What brought about the declines of the European colonial empires, and how do these declines compare to the American experience? Are empires a thing of the past, or will some new empire emerge in the 21st century? Our guest is Alfred McCoy, one of the editors of Endless Empire, Spain's Retreat, Europe's Eclipse, America's Decline, published in 2012 by the University of Wisconsin Press.
Welcome back to University of the Year.
Thank you, Emily.
You have an illustration in your book of the marble statue installed inside the U.S. Capitol Rotunda showing George Washington seated like Zeus at Mount Olympus. And it's got a motto that your title comes from. I was wondering if you could share that motto and talk about your choice of the title Endless Empire.
Right. Reading from Virgil's Aeneid, which Virgil wrote for Emperor Caesar Augustus as his patron, it reads as follows. And Jupiter, king of the gods, said, young Romulus will take the leadership, build walls of Mars, and call by his own name his people Romans. For these I set no limits, world or time, but make the gift of empire without end. And that's where we got the title of our book from, Endless Empire. Because that is the assumption that almost every empire makes at the peak of its power, the British in their day and Americans in ours. And if you look at the wide-ranging political debate in the United States over this election and recent elections, there is almost no admission, no willingness to admit on the part of any major politician that there might be anything akin to American decline. It is simply assumed that our power is forever. And the very narrow board debate is over the tactics of magnifying that power, assuring it continues. And there's no willingness, in fact, quite the opposite, to admit that it may be in decline.
But isn't there an irony if you have a quote that has to do with Romans when we know there was a decline and fall of the Roman Empire? Isn't it almost implying that any American empire will fall?
All empires end. That's the nature of the dynamic world system. You can track back 3,000 years and find that there is an endless succession of empires. They rise, they last more or less, and then they inevitably decline and fade into something else. And it's not an abrupt process, okay? Sure, sometimes it happens as abruptly as, let's say, the Japanese Empire, which is actually history's both shortest and largest empire, collapsing dramatically in the nuclear bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. But that's extraordinary. That's an empire born of war and destroyed in war. What the usual form is that they evolve, they arise, oftentimes in collaboration as well as competition with the dominant imperial power. They achieve through a complex array a certain moment of hegemony, of dominion. And then slowly that erodes as either a succession of powers or a new dominant power emerges. And this is 3,000 years of human history. So it's a fairly safe bet to assume that empires, all empires, the American Imperium included, will come to an end. And it's fairly safe to assume that the power will be transferred within the global system to either a single dominant power, as it has been for the last 50 years in the world, or actually the last 20 years. We shared power with the Soviet Union in the Cold War but over the past 20 years, we've been the world's sole superpower. In the age of European empires, it was half a dozen empires, rather weak powers, dominating half of humanity more or less in concert. So it's a question of when and what the form of the transition will be. Empires are always in transition, and that's what's truly surprising about American leaders. First of all, you know, we're an empire that dare not say the name. Unlike any empire that's ever preceded us, we don't embrace the concept or the idea that we are a dominant power. We speak in euphemisms of American leadership or promoting freedom, but we don't actually engage the reality of the sheer weight of American dominance. And as I indicated in that passage from my book, Endless Empire, that I read at the outset, you know, that dominion was overweening. It's the United States is the most powerful empire in human history, bar none. But since we as a nation, in part because of the Cold War and the Soviets branding us as an imperial power, a succession to the British, the French, the Dutch, and the rest, we denied it because it was a political point from our enemies. So instead of analyzing the nature of American power, what is distinctive about it, what does it share in similarities with other dominant powers, other empires, we have this whole rhetoric of American exceptionalism. We have the most distinguished American diplomatic historians of the Cold War era simply flatly denying that America was anything akin to an imperial power and arguing such things, such transparently specious arguments that Britain had a colonial ministry, we did not, therefore, because we didn't have a colonial ministry, we weren't an imperial power. If you look at a more fluid model of U.S. empire, you'd have to say that the United States began to develop global power that had all of the trappings, all of the earmarks akin to empire, but an empire of a certain kind.
I was going to say, and that would that kind of empire would include at least the nominal liberation of former American colonies, the Philippines, Cuba to some extent. And one historian has made the point that as an empire, if you want to use that word, that we pick and choose our states that we pick up to. We could have had Mexico at one point, decided, you know, chose not to. It's a somewhat more selective empire maybe than some have been.
Well, first of all, when we talk about selective empire, types of empire, we have to realize that Britain, Great Britain at its peak, had two distinct components to a single global empire. Britain ruled over at peak circa 1900 a quarter of humanity, about 400 million people, through direct colonial rule. Okay, and these were British colonies and territories. But what the British Empire builders were acutely aware of is that their preferred mode of imperial dominion was something called informal empire. And the architect of this, the great British foreign minister, Lord Palmerston, said that it is much more profitable to trade with civilized men than it is to govern savages. And so governing savages is what the quarter of the empire did through colonies. But trading with civilized men was what the other quarter of the British Empire did through what are called subordinate elites. And this included emperors from China to Istanbul, kings from Thailand to Egypt, and Republican presidents from Caracas to Santiago. Okay, Lord Canning said it best. He was the British foreign minister in the 1820s when the Spanish Empire suffered its major blow with the liberation of Latin America and went from being the greatest of territorial empires to one of the smallest overnight. And Lord Canning wrote, Spanish America or Latin America is free, and unless we make a mistake, she shall be British. Okay, and that's synonymous. That's simultaneity of free and British. That's the British informal empire in a nutshell. And what did that comprise? At that point, this was beginning the dawn of the industrial age. British engineering was exporting things like cast iron for lighthouses that marked the sea lanes, building the rails around the world. They produced the rails and the locomotives and the base for much of the rolling stock. They financed the development of plantations and export industries under the global free trade that was the hallmark of British Empire, both formal and informal. And they had, at peak in 1900, 300 capital ships and 30 naval bastions from Halifax to Bermuda Bermuda, Gibraltar, Suez, Bombay, and Singapore, okay, that were strategically placed on the sea lanes and in concert with the United States, preserve the security of the seas, having suppressed piracy and slavery earlier on in the century, and in collaboration with the United States, we're preserving a kind of global naval balance. So that system of an overarching military control of the globe through the military high ground, the dominant military technology of the day, naval power, with direct rule through colonies and indirect rule through informal empire, was the hallmark of the British Empire.
How did they get that kind of power? If you think of Great Britain being such a small country, and yet, you know, you've got the sun never sets on the British Empire. They had such an incredible global reach. If you take a look through sort of a historical lens at how they got that kind of dominance and maintained it for such a time, what are the lessons there?
Well, first of all, the informal empire they gained through a mix of military coercion. That naval might gave the British the right to shell or to blockade and to isolate powers from the sea, which represented absolute isolation from global commerce and intercourse. So they could do that. That gave them the leverage to keep these client regimes in power and in line. But the key to British global power, you know, how they ruled basically half of humanity with an army that around 1900 was no more than 99,000 men. Now, how do you do that? Well, the key to British success, and this is something that the great British historians have discovered, was through a leverage of power, what they called subordinate elites. Okay, and Ronald Robinson, the great British imperial historian, has made the argument that the British Empire rose so that the sun would never set upon it, because around the world it formed alliances in its direct colonies and its indirect empire through these subordinate elites. So the British Empire, the quarter of humanity that were in the colonies, actually rested upon Fiji chiefs, Malay sultans, Indian maharajas, Kikuyu chiefs, and Nigerian emirs. In other words, the British at the local district level around the globe formed alliances with local influentials, chiefs, sultans, maharajas, reinforced their power, and made them the instruments of British colonial rule. And that allowed Britain to basically run its empire for the better part of a century. And then Ronald Robinson said, and then how? How did the British Empire collapse so quickly? How did they go from ruling over 700 million people in 1945 and only 5 million people 20 years later? Because the idea of nationalism arose and those subordinate elites broke with Britain, shed the empire right around the globe, and the British Empire collapsed in the blink of history's eye. And that level of subordinate elites is critical to British imperial power, just as it's central to American imperial power today.
Well, a friend of mine from, I think, New Delhi said that the reason the sun never set on the British Empire is because God didn't trust the British in the dark. And it does lead me to wonder, though, what you're talking, you mentioned, Al, that there is no discussion whatsoever, if you want to call it denial or what, in this country about the erosion, the decline of what we could call the American Empire. Was there time for that kind of discussion in Britain? Is there any kind of precedent for a national discussion on what's happening to our empire?
The British, on the whole, unlike the French, understood that their time was finite. And they understood that although they celebrated the empire and they profited from it enormously, but that imperial rule rested upon ultimately their legitimacy in a curious sense, their legitimacy and in another curious sense, the consent of the governed, or at least the leaders of the governed. And as early as 1942, the Times of London wrote that the British Empire is a self-liquidating concern. In other words, the idea of liberty and order, okay, that were the two hallmarks of the British Empire, that that pairing, okay, was an unstable pairing, that the idea of libertas, liberty, which was central to the British Empire, just as freedom is to our own, meant that those people who were being subordinated into colonies or into an informal empire would eventually assert themselves, and that was part of the engine, the part of the kind of institutional DNA of the British Empire. So they understood it, okay? And on the whole, you know, they worked for, you know, managed transitions. They negotiated with local elites, sometimes in the case of Burma, quite successfully. But then, like every imperial power, they suffered from one of those factors that is very contributory, almost catalytic in imperial decline, what we call micromilitarism, that empires at their peak are extraordinarily rational in their application of military force. But when they start in this process of decline, the psychopathology of losing that power, that sense of might and dominion, blinds imperial powers. So they get into something called imperial hubris, and they make terrible miscalculations of the kind that they would never have made at the peak of their power. So there's a kind of paradoxical relationship. As you decline, you overemphasize your military power, even as it's fading. And the classic, of course, of micromilitarism was the British Suez intervention. I mean, they combined with the French.
In 1956, right?
They combined with the French. They had an armada of aircraft carriers. The Israelis attacked in Sinai, smashed the Egyptian tanks and infantry forces. The British bombed. The Egyptian Air Force had to flee to safe havens. The British occupied, in concert with the French, Sinai and captured the canal. And because it ran against the grain of nationalism, the United States could not support it. It forced a rupture between Britain and the United States, very uncommon in that exceptionally close alliance. And within weeks, the British had to begin to pull out, and they suffered a clear reversal. It was a micromilitary disaster.
And what was the ideology behind the empire? In other words, the way we think of manifest destiny or different things, what would be, you know, if you think of Rudyard Kipling and just different folks who've come along in England to try to justify why Great Britain should have ever had such a far-reaching control, why there should be all these British colonies all over the world. What was the ideology behind it?
Well, the dominant ideology that I think held the whole apparatus together, the global naval dominion, the quarter of humanity under direct rule in the colonies, and the other quarter of humanity in the British informal empire, was free trade. You know, the British provided a global order, the mechanisms of commerce, the means of finance, the insurance. At peak in 1900, the city of London had nearly £4 billion overseas in investments. Britain was the dominant player in the world economy. British engineering was at the lead. And so by providing free trade, providing access of people engaged in extractive industries and productive industries around the globe to the avenues of commerce, which the British Navy assured, they brought prosperity and ultimately order to the world. And then there were sort of, you know, smaller bore institutions. The British were not quite so, because they did not emerge in the time of the Cold War. They were not quite so clear in the overarching ideology of their empire. But I think they felt that they stood for civilization, and that was the word they would use. They stood for humanity. They stood for the rule of law. They stood for something they would have called fair play. And they brought the artifacts of British civilization, particularly the English language, and it's the British that made English the world's global language. We simply picked up on that. They brought also sport, the idea of conditioning. In those days, it was manhood on the playing fields. And they brought cricket and, to a lesser extent, rugby to the world. Ultimately, over time, they brought the Westminster parliamentary system, which is, I think, actually to their credit, has proven, and again, this is something somebody should study, but I think it's proven to be a more stable system, less inclined to authoritarianism than the American-style presidential system, which creates a kind of all-powerful executive rather than a prime minister that arises from a majority party on the floor of a parliament. And the array of British institutions is really quite impressive. Another one, of course, is the Anglican Church, right? Which the worldwide Anglican Communion is the second largest Christian denomination after the Roman Catholic Church. And so the combination of all of these created a kind of an ethos of culture, an ideology of liberty, of law, of fair play, of economic opportunity, that the British didn't distill into a single overarching ideology like we're inclined to do, but was nonetheless very powerful, very persuasive at the time. And that's another thing, you know, that we call it now soft power. Every empire in its age, to be a successful empire, has got to have some overarching ideology that captivates a large percentage of the population and enlists the loyalty of subordinate elites. The Soviet Empire had communism, Marxism. The Spanish Empire had Catholicism. Okay, it was there was a very close alliance between church and state in the Spanish Empire. And the British had the array we've just talked about. And the American array, of course, is overarching freedom, liberty, rule of law, human rights recently, the rights of women. Okay, it's, we encode it all in freedom. But when you begin to break it down, it has many of the apparatuses of the British Empire.
And we'll look further at that comparison between the British Empire and America today when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach, and our guest is Alfred McCoy. He's one of the editors and contributors to the book Endless Empire, Spain's Retreat, Europe's Eclipse, America's Decline. And of all the empires you could pick, Al, why do you mention Spain in particular in the title?
Because most people, when they study the Spanish Empire historically, have looked at the rise of Spanish power. And very few people have actually examined Spain's very long decline, which really goes on for about 130 or 40 years. They went from being the world's most powerful empire. After all, they were the ones that created the template of the modern imperial power. You know, truly a worldwide empire that stretched across Latin America.
Reached their peak by what, about 1810,
No, they were already beginning. They lost Portugal much earlier, but I'd say by the 18th, really the peak was probably around the early 18th century. Okay, when the economics of the empire was still in fairly good shape. Spain had already been eclipsed as a naval power. They lost the Low Countries in the late 16th century. The Low Countries being modern day Belgium and the Netherlands. So they had suffered some landed reverses in Europe already, but the international empire, the global empire, was still very strong. And then, beginning with the Latin American revolutions, which by 1824 meant they lost effectively all of Latin America, that vast continent, and they were down to a small empire of islands that included Cuba, Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Marianas, and the Philippines. And then in the Spanish-American War of 1898, they lost all of that. And they then recoiled by conquering northern Morocco and holding on to that until the 1950s when they began to give away everything. So there's really 150 years of Spanish decline, and Spain's experience allows us to see more clearly what the dynamics of that decline are. First of all, one of the things you discover is that without a thriving domestic economy, and Spain was losing out with the rise of the Industrial Revolution, that maintaining the extraordinary revenues for a global force projection is not sustainable, is not possible. And when you think about it, national defense in almost every society arises organically from within the borders of a nation. The weapons factories, the taxes, the military service, whether it's volunteer or regular, this is easy to mount and maintain. The bases are on sovereign territory. Once you go overseas, the processes of maintaining a force beyond the borders of a nation become astronomically more expensive in every single way imaginable.
Logistics of crossing the globe alone are daunting.
Are daunting, and maintaining the apparatus of foreign force projection is enormously expensive in every age over the past 400 years. And so these require extraordinary revenues. And unless you have a dynamic society that's capable of producing those extraordinary revenues, and in the case of Britain, its global defense posture was 2.5% of gross domestic product, and at our peak it was about 5.5%. Okay, so that doesn't sound like much, but carving that out of a society with many demands is difficult. So Spain began to decline economically, and then Spain is actually very revealing in a key facet of imperial decline, which we call micromilitarism. Spain reacted to the loss of its Latin American empire with kind of delay. In between 1858 and 1864, Spain conducted 6 micromilitary operations where they sort of rampaged around the Caribbean and up and down the coast of west coast of Latin America, trying to recover its empire. It collaborated with the French in an ill-fated expedition into Vietnam. The Spanish pulled out. The French persisted and turned that into a viable colony. And then after the war of the Spanish-American War of 1898, the Spanish then plunged into North Africa. They had a long-standing enclave, and they decided to expand that by conquering the Rif region, the Atlas Mountains of North Morocco. And they miscalculated. Their military was in terribly bad shape. The Berber guerrillas rose up. They slaughtered the Spanish army in the Battle of Anual. Somewhere between 13,000 and 20,000 Spanish soldiers were slaughtered, dead on the battlefield. I mean, we lost 58,000 troops in Vietnam. Imagine losing 13,000 to 20,000 troops in a single battle. It was a slaughter. And the Spanish redoubled. They formed the Spanish Foreign Legion. They conducted a massive aerial bombardment using poison gas, the first extensive and one of the only extensive. The Italians did it in Ethiopia later on. It was the first. They had the world's first amphibious landing.
And I know why were they doing this? It was just to regain national pride.
To regain national pride. To conquer this profitless
arid. Just to beat somebody.
This profitless arid terrain. I mean, if you could pick any place in the world where you'd be guaranteed not to make a peseta, okay, from imperial conquest, North Morocco would be it. I don't know if you ever...
I've been there, yeah.
It's overpopulated, it's dry, the goats have to climb trees to eat the leaves. I mean, it's just...
So this would be, like you were talking about, where an empire, when it starts to decline, seems to flail about and make some not so smart judgment calls in terms of military action.
Are you going to compare that to Grenada?
Well, that's where actually scholars have done that. Okay, I mean, let's look at the American case. Okay, we had a searing defeat in Vietnam, an absolutely searing defeat. We spent hundreds of billions of dollars. We lost 58,000 American lives. We threw basically half of our standing military forces into that battle, and we lost in the end. And we so exhausted American society, we so divided the country with these astronomical casualties, that the United States really had no capacity to project force beyond our borders in any significant way for an entire decade, arguably for 15 years. It wasn't really till the Gulf War that we had sufficient strength to mount a foreign military operation. And we had two operations. One, we mounted a full Navy battle fleet in order to occupy this tiny Caribbean island of Grenada, and had this celebratory event under President Reagan in Washington, D.C., as if we just won the Franco-Prussian War or something. I mean, it was absurd. And then, of course, we sent our forces into Lebanon, where tragically nearly 300 were killed in that detonation. And we recoiled. I mean, we pulled back.
Right? Well, those were both in the Reagan administration.
Yeah, in the aftermath of Vietnam. And one could make the argument, all right, and only, we're going to need some historical perspective. One could make the argument, when you think about the rational exercise of military power and the shifting dynamics of the world economy, do you really send your armed forces into Iraq for nearly a decade and waste $1 trillion that you need for research, education, infrastructure development to compete in a dynamic and fast-changing world economy in which the American share of world trade is dropping steadily, in which American indices of educational performance are crashing. American technological edge is being lost, okay? And so what do? You sink, basically, depending on if you take Joseph Stiglitz's statistics, $3 trillion into these two wars, you know, spill our national treasure into the desert sands. And what have we accomplished? I mean, what have we substantially accomplished in terms of the exercise of U.S. global power? What are our gains?
And do you hear, when you heard Cheney and Rumsfeld and others talking about that, do you hear echoes of imperial language?
Yeah,
or
because,
is it too euphemistic?
No. I mean, again, within the euphemisms of the American rhetoric of empire, very much so. The idea was that we were going to... It was a bold imperial stroke, okay, akin to the U.S. conquest of the Philippines back in 1898. What did we hope to accomplish by taking these islands off the coast of China? Well, with one stroke, we would insert the United States into one of the main arteries of imperial commerce, and we would gain a kind of foothold that would give us access to the China market. That would be part of a string of coaling stations for U.S. naval power. And we would become the preeminent Pacific power, would be poised on the edge of Asia to participate in that very lucrative imperial commerce. And I think the neoconservative Republicans had a similar vision that we would transform Iraq. We would turn it from being an enemy, an opponent, into being all of its oil revenues, into a bastion of freedom and democracy in the Middle East, and that would spread throughout the region. And so the American vision for the world would be magnified in a region that has so far not joined that vision. I think they had some bold idea. I think they also felt that they could probably use it as a launching pad for the invasion and conquest of Iran and the toppling of a hostile regime in Syria. Okay, instead, the opposite happened. Syria and Iran turned their territories into bases for Al-Qaeda terrorists, and we plunged into 6-7 years of devastating counter-guerrilla warfare. It didn't work out the way they planned.
And if we look at this from an administration standpoint, what would have been the alternative to inaction, or what would have happened had we not taken action?
Well, first of all, Saddam Hussein was confined, all right? Sanctions, air overflights, had him completely contained.
No-fly zones?
Yeah, the no-fly zones. There was no need for any military invasion. That regime could have just simply wound itself down. We could have do what we did in Libya. There was no need for an invasion, all right? The normal measures, the no-fly zones, the sanctions— the prodding, the support for democratic forces, that could have yielded some kind of slow evolutionary change in regime over time. This was a brutal totalitarian regime that was economically mismanaged, that there were many alternative forces inside that society. There were all alternative means, the kind of alternative means that we used in Libya and that we are now trying to use in Syria, right?
And trying to use it in Iran. Mm-hmm.
Yes, but that's more complicated. We are using the sanctions in Iran, and we are in a guarded way trying to promote pro-democracy forces inside that country. Recognizing, I think, in the case of Libya, in the case of Syria, and in the case of Iran, that the kind of long-term change that's going to produce a dynamic civil society and a democratic culture ultimately has to come from within, and that it's best to encourage those forces for a long gestation, for them to take their own course, and you can try and set certain parameters. But a overt military invasion is a high-stakes gamble because you're rupturing a continuous social development. You don't know how that's going to work out.
It's in a democracy where you're being up for re-election every 4 years. I guess it's harder to sell patience than it is to sell action, even if it's turning out to be ill-advised.
Well, this administration, the Obama administration, during its 4 years, went away from unilateralism to multilateralism.
And then the opposition says, well, what happened to American leadership?
Yes, right. Right.
So you can't win.
And American leadership, of course, is a code for untrammeled American hegemony and global dominion.
And let me ask you about that, because one of the things you said about the British Empire was its use of, what did you call it, sub-elites, finding...
Subordinate elites.
Subordinate elites. It seems to me, looking at American actions over the last half century, we've done that too, where you find a Mubarak or you find someone in Venezuela or in Guatemala, or you prop up certain not so desirable figures in order to have them as allies. Are we sort of following the example of the British in that way?
Yes, very much so. As we said earlier, the British had a system of two types of subordinate elites, the kind of regional local leaders, sultans, chiefs, maharajas, in their directly ruled colonies. And then they had kings, emperors, prime ministers in the informal empire. In the 20 years after World War II, really from the late 1940s to the late 1960s, about half of humanity gained freedom in some form from a half dozen European empires. And so the locus of power moved up from the districts to the presidential palaces of 100 new nations that emerged from the ruins of these half-dozen European empires. And it fell to the Eisenhower administration to deal with this sudden change in the global geopolitics. The number of members of the United Nations doubled under Eisenhower's term in office. And so what Eisenhower did, being a very skillful military commander, a senior staff officer, was he created an apparatus for the management of this new world order, the National Security Council. And they met periodically. They met on a weekly basis under Eisenhower. And if you look at the minutes of the meetings of the U.S. National Security Council, they go continent to continent, country to country, systematically reviewing the situation and reviewing America's options. And at one point, the Secretary of Treasury, Humphrey, came in with a report saying that our embrace of democracy in Latin America is ill-founded, and we really should think about backing authoritarian regimes because they'll be more pro-American. And Eisenhower said with acute insight, you mean if they're RSOBs, they're okay. Okay, mm-hmm. And that was the mechanism. And so the body for the implementation of the decisions of the National Security Council to manage these subordinate elites, to assure that reliable ones got into power, that they stayed in power, that those who were anti-U.S. or unreliable in some way were knocked out of power, was the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency. And when you think about the era of the Cold War, what we don't realize, I think in retrospect, although there's a lot of romantic and kind of spy stories and James Bond stuff, actually much of the management of the imperium, the empires that were either waning or ascending. The Soviet Union used the KGB and its surrogates, the Stasi Securitate, in the dozen occupied nations of Eastern Europe. We used the CIA. President Eisenhower authorized 170 covert operations in 48 countries around the world. During the 1960s and 1970s, there were 38 coups. The government changed hands in a quarter of the nations of the world through a military coup, and the CIA was behind much of that. The United States was cultivating military leaders as alternative subordinate elites. So around the globe, you know, we put these elites in power, we kept them in power through aid and development, and when they crossed us, we would often replace a unreliable civilian leader like Patrice Lumumba in Congo with a reliable military leader like Joseph Mobutu, or when it was Prime Minister Mossadegh in Iran, we replaced him with General Zahedi, who was kind of a cat's paw surrogate for the Shah. And so it went right around the globe. And that was how we exercised our power. And one of the really interesting things that we learned, because usually it takes us 20, 30, 40 years as historians to figure out what's going on. But thanks to Brian Manning and Julian Assange and WikiLeaks, we have now 251,000 U.S. diplomatic cables, not from the 1950s and 60s, but from 2007, 2008, 2009, okay? 251,000 recent diplomatic cables. And when you read through them, I haven't read all 251,000, I must admit, okay? So my homework is incomplete.
Get back to us when you have.
All right, well, okay. Either that or my estate attorney will. Anyway, but I went through about 1,000, 1,100 of them. with a research assistant fairly selectively. And what emerges from them is what you see U.S. embassies around the world doing is they're keeping a close eye on, first of all, the person in power, looking for foibles. I mean, for example, there's one cable to the U.S. embassy in Bahrain saying, did the princes drink or use drugs? Let us know.
So looking for vulnerabilities.
Mm-hmm. Looking for vulnerabilities, looking for attributes, points of influence and access. And then also cultivating alternative subordinate elites, finding people who are reliable. And so if you, when you read through that, you get a sense also not only of the U.S. managing the system of subordinate elites, but also that the system is not working terribly well. And you can think about some of the indices of waning U.S. power. I mean, let's look back over the last decade. Everybody's forgotten the U.S. support for the attempted coup against Hugo Chavez in 2002. But that stands in marked contrast to those 38 coups back at the apex of American power in the 1960s and 1970s, where when American just whispered coup, governments would topple from the awesome breath of American power. Well, we lent ourselves to the overthrowing of Chavez, and his government wavered for 2 days, but he came storming back into power, and he's just been reelected. Right. That didn't mm-hmm. work. And we attempted the same thing in Georgia. We tried to detach the nation of Georgia from the southern tier of Russian power, and that hasn't worked, okay? Russia invaded. They've kept their client states that have carved out of Georgia. And then in 2009, we backed the Green Revolution in Iran against the current regime there, and that didn't work. So there are signs of waning U.S. power. Moreover, we're seeing things like the rise of the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China. And actually, it's brick-ass South Africa. And these are strong states, dynamic. The Brazilian Development Bank is now lending as much money as the World Bank, okay, in Latin America. And so we're seeing challenges to U.S. power from these rising powers. We're moving, like it or not, into a multipolar world where there's, first of all, the BRICS, and behind them are the next 11. There are regional powers like Turkey, Indonesia, that are coming up very strong. These are nations with a strong sense of trajectory, of power, of prestige, and they are not as easily to manage as they once were. So it's a multipolar changing world that we're living in, and we're losing, I think, our control over those subordinate elites, which have been central to our power over the past 50 years. Let's remember what happened with the British. British Empire rose on the backs of those subordinate elites, and as Ronald Robinson, the great British historian, once said, and when they decided to break with Britain, you know, in the blink of an eye, in less than a generation, that whole empire unraveled. Well, now that our subordinate elites are beginning to question American power, beginning to deal with each other directly, and the multilateral apparatus of power changing, necessarily our control over these subordinate elites is waning, and our power is waning with them.
Is the American Empire in a decline? We're going to talk about that when we continue in a moment with University of the Year. In contrast to Britain's dominion over land and sea, America's global reach seems bent on a century-long trajectory beyond sovereign territory toward control over interstitial domains, space, cyberspace, sky, and the electromagnetic spectrum. That's a sentence from the conclusion to our guest Alfred McCoy's book, Endless Empire, Spain's Retreat, Europe's Eclipse, and America's Decline. As we're talking about the American Empire, can you say something about it was the final presidential debate in October when foreign policy came up with the famous horse and bayonet line about military power and how that fits into our concept about American control of the world.
Sure. Let me just quote, because I've got it right in front of me. Mitt Romney said, our Navy is now smaller at any time since 1917, and he complained that the number of U.S. Navy ships was under 285. And then in words that absolutely drenched with disdain, I mean, the one time in the debates that Obama almost sneered at Romney. Obama shot back, "Well, Governor, we also have fewer horses and bayonets because the nature of our military has changed. We have these things called aircraft carriers where planes land on them. We have these ships that go underwater, nuclear submarines. And so the question is not a game of battleship where we're counting ships. It's what are our capabilities?" And then later on in the debate, Obama gave a hint of what he thought those capabilities should be and are. He said, "What I did was work with our Joint Chiefs of Staff to think about what are we going to need in the future to make sure that we are safe. We need to be thinking about cybersecurity. We need to be talking about space." And not a single commentator I've seen has actually asked themselves, what does this mean? And what's really been going on is over the past 4 years, President Obama has picked up on trends that came really out, I think, in his 2012 defense strategy and budget. He has authorized an overall, I think, a 10 or 11% cut in the U.S. defense budget. And then a marked shift, okay, away from the kind of behemoths of the industrial age, the big artillery guns, the big Navy ships, the tanks, the trucks, the armored personnel carriers, and all the rest. And he's made a systematic shift to a global information regime that's going to rest on advanced biometrics, cyber warfare, and one aspect of U.S. defense policy that most Americans are completely aware of, the full weaponization of space. Most people are not aware that the new age in American defense began in one of those very quiet moments. I think it was April 2010 when the U.S. lofted the X-37B into space. There are two prototypes. It flew around, it came down, it landed. And what's the X-37B? It's the first space drone, okay? It can be shot into space. It looks like it's 29 feet long. It looks like a very cute Challenger space shuttle, except it's unmanned, right? Very cheap, comparatively. And then once it's up there, you can fly it with a joystick. And it's got a capacious cargo bay, which allows, let's say, triple Terminator missiles to knock out an enemy satellite or the repositioning or reconstruction of American satellite. This is the first attempt. And what the Pentagon has been building under the Obama administration, building upon trends that have been developing decades, but really concretizing it under his administration, is a three-tier space canopy. Okay, at the lowest level on the ground are the Reapers and Predators, and above them, we will have in a couple of years an armada of 99 global hawks that have amazing surveillance capacity. Then up above them, the next step up in kind of the lower stratosphere, we're going to have these winged solar aircraft that can fly for 5 years continuously around the globe because if the prototypes work out, the early prototypes have worked. It'll have a 400-foot wingspan with solar panels on the wingspan. And then we're going to have a hypersonic vehicle, and we've had two test launches which have both crashed, but they can fly anywhere in the world in 2 hours. They fly at 13,000 miles an hour and can destroy any target in the world in 2 hours. And then up above them, out there in the exosphere, we've got the X-37B, all right? And, of course, the global high ground is really the satellites. And in 2007, China really upset the Pentagon in the United States because it fired a missile up and shot down one of their own satellites, which means that, you know—
They have the capability to do it.
Anybody has the capability. Anybody's got a missile, and everybody's got a missile can knock out satellite. And our entire three Cs— communication command and control of the U.S. military is satellite-based. And so not only have we built the X-37B to be able to strike at enemy satellites should they strike at ours, okay, but we've also been developing the F-6. And this is a fractionated satellite system in which we will now loft components. And they will – so instead of having a big bird, a big satellite about the size of this table that's got all the components in it, we're going to have a fractionated system where the components will be scattered in space, communicating by a microwave technology.
So you can't knock it out with one hit.
Right. Or if one component goes bad, there'll be a backup component lost in space, or the X-37B can zip up there and release one. Okay. And so what we're building, okay, is a comprehensive three-tier global system. Now, you might say, what about global sovereignty? I mean, how can this apparatus hover above the earth? Aren't we going to violate the sovereignty of the nations? Well, you know, how high is sovereignty? okay? There is no international law. In 1910, there was an international Paris Convention, okay, which discussed this question. They couldn't reach a resolution, and there is no law. So if you ask some puckish Pentagon lawyer how high is sovereignty, that lawyer might say, he or she, as high as you can enforce it. And so basically, we have now created this global high ground where we and then the Chinese by 2020 are going to be the only two people out there with a global satellite system and the technology to manage it. In combination with global biometric identification and cyber warfare, we're looking at a shift, okay, of warfare into these domains whereby entire battles could be fought and machines come crashing down, but not a human being lost.
Well, it sounds as if you are saying that you do not think the American empire is on the decline then.
Well, here's the trick, okay? We got the toys, we got the weapons, but let's not forget, let's go back to one of history's last and least successful empires, the Nazi empire. Okay, at the very end, that amazing German engineering produced what Hitler called his wonder weapons, okay? His tanks had far superior metallurgy and armor than Allied tanks. The British and American tanks could not stand up to the German tanks. They created the V-2 rockets that rained down without block upon London. At the end of World War II, we had these lumbering propeller aircrafts where the Nazis had these Messerschmitt fighters that could come from 20,000 feet at 600 miles an hour and just take our bombers right out of the sky. The British High Command said that unless we win the war by July of 1945, Germany will capture control of the skies over Europe. I mean, okay, so they thought they were going to hold on to their world empire through wonder weapons. And actually, it turns out that, of course, empires are more complex organisms. So, you know, it's ambiguous at this point. Yes, we're creating this amazing technology for global dominion. But this technology can only operate if, first of all, it's got to be constantly renewed. Because one of the geniuses of technology is once you create something that's just absolutely amazing and unimaginable, well, then it becomes commonplace very quickly, you know. And so you've got to be constantly renewing it. Well, let's look at the foundation for this, the American education system. Okay, there's something called the International PISA test, which measured the capacity of 15-year-old high school kids around the globe. In 2009, kids in Shanghai came number one in science and math. And where was the United States? At number 24 and number 31. And so it goes. Every index of U.S. educational performance in critical areas of science and technology is going downward with each passing year because we are not investing in our educational infrastructure. So you might say, who cares if a bunch of 15-year-old Chinese kids in 2009 came number one in those tests? Well, I'll tell you what. In 2024, okay, those will be 30-year-old scientists and engineers at their absolute peak.
And military leaders.
Yeah, and they're going to be in the very sophisticated. Our space engineers, the people that built our glorious space program, are very old now. They're much older. The Chinese space program has a much younger demographic profile, and they're being renewed by these super smart kids that are coming out of those schools with this measured, absolutely established superior ability. So, yes, we're right now in the process of creating these amazing weapons, but the structure, the economic structure, the educational infrastructure, all of that is waning. Our advantage is being eroded day by day so that when we get to the next generation, not the first generation space drone like the X-37B, but the fourth or fifth generation, it's very possible that the more sophisticated technology, the people that will capture the global high ground ruling the Earth from space might be the Chinese, not the United States.
A look into the future and certainly a look at the past, too, as it pertains to empires and empire building. Always fascinating to have you with us, Alfred McCoy.
Thank you, Norman.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.